Welcome to the Title League podcast. My name is Trish, and today I am honored to be joined by a two-time NBA champion, Coach Phil Handy. Phil, thank you so much for being here with us today.
Trish, thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure.
Let's get started by talking a little bit about how you got into basketball. How old were you when you first picked up a ball?
Man, I was, if I remember correctly, I was 5 years old, Trish. You know, I come from a pretty big family. I got five older brothers and one sister. So all of my older brothers played basketball. And me being the last, I wanted to follow in their footsteps. So I started bouncing the basketball about the age of five.
And did you always have a passion for it? Did you pick it up easily, or was it something that you had to work on?
Yeah, man, I think all of the above. I always liked it because my brothers liked it, you know. So as the youngest sibling, I wanted to be like them in whatever way I could. The passion for it, I think as I got older, it really grew. It really grew. And I don't think I came a really what I consider a good player until late in my teenage years, 16, 17, 18. I was a little bit of a late bloomer with basketball. I mean, but I played it pretty much my whole life. I loved it. And absolutely, I mean, I had to put in a lot of work on the game to be, you know, to get a scholarship to college, to be able to go on and play professional basketball. It took a lot of work.
And let's talk about that. What was the route that you went out on? So did you go straight to college? What college did you play for?
Yeah, my path wasn't the most traditional way. I actually had to go to junior college for a couple of years. You know, my background was as such that I really only played maybe 5 or 6 games of high school basketball. I didn't play very much high school basketball. You know, I was always one of, like I said, by the time I was 17, I was one of the best players in my school, but I wasn't really part of the basketball program. So for me, I didn't have any real scholarship offers. Colleges didn't know anything about me because I didn't really play too much. So I went to junior college for 2 years, and then I started getting recruited by pretty much every school in the country because I was, you know, finally getting a chance to play. And I ended up going to University of Hawaii, which was an awesome experience for me, just learning about the Polynesian culture, the Japanese culture, the Hawaiian culture. It was so different over there. That was great for me, and I left Hawaii after a couple years of playing, and then I started my pro career. And my first NBA team was the Golden State Warriors, which is my hometown. Mm-hmm. And I was able to play for them my first year. And my second year, I went to Portland Trail Blazers, and then after that, I took my talents overseas. I went to play in Europe for about 8.5 years. And once I went to Europe, I never came back. I just, it was probably, for all intents and purposes, probably the best thing that happened in my life. Going to Europe, it really just opened my eyes up to, you know, another way of living, other qualities of life, and really just learning about different cultures. So I spent a lot of time in Europe, in France, in Italy, Germany, Spain, England, Israel, Australia. Basketball has kind of taken me around the world.
That's amazing. So you immersed yourself in all of these cultures. You would have been pretty young. Did you pick up any languages?
I did. You know, I mean, obviously being in every country, you know, your coaches are usually from that country. And so they some of them speak English, some of them don't. So, you know, my first opportunity in Europe was in France. And if you know anything about the French culture, you know, they're not very fond of anyone that doesn't speak French. So I had to pick up on the language as much as I could. I think I understood it better than I can speak it. You know, so being around my coaches and my teammates everywhere I went, I tried to pick up on cues of the language as much as I could. And obviously, you know, when I leave and go home, you know, you kind of get back to your roots. So unfortunately, I don't remember any of the languages that I picked up. But, you know, at the time, I mean, I spoke a little bit of French. I spoke a little bit of Italian. I learned Spanish, you know, I learned Hebrew. I was learning all these different languages, which I wish, if I was a smart man, and took a page out of Kobe's book, I would have picked up on all of these languages and been fluent in them to this day.
So you might not have held on to the languages that you learned at the time, but definitely having the experience of being coached by individuals who didn't speak English, how did that experience carry forward in your training and your coaching skills?
Yeah, no, I think what the beautiful thing about basketball is that it's a universal sport, and it really only has one language. So I don't care what language you speak when you step on the basketball court, it's all the same. So whether my coaches spoke English or not, I knew exactly what they were trying to get across to me as a player. And that's, to me, man, I think that's one of the most amazing things about sport in general is, all language barriers are usually knocked down once you get involved with sport, because it's just a competitive part of the sport takes over. So I didn't have any issues. It was really, again, just really paying attention to coaches' body language and their movements. And I was always able to figure out exactly what my coaches wanted from me.
And was it during this time that you started to realize that you wanted to go into a training capacity or a coaching capacity once you were done playing professionally?
You know, that's a great question, Trish. I really, I retired officially in 2003 from professional basketball. You know, I played a little bit over 10 years. I didn't really get into the training world and think about training until about 1999. I was in Australia and I had a couple kids, parents to say, hey, Coach Phil, have you ever thought about working with kids and kind of teaching them some of the things that you know? And, I hadn't really thought about it, but, we had this program in Australia where we would actually go to high schools and, spend time with the kids and teach them some drills. And I kind of started to fall in love with just working with the kids. And so I started doing some training in Australia on my off days. A couple of days a week, I would take two or three kids and do some private sessions with them. And I just remember the satisfaction that I got from it, from working with the kids and one, seeing their faces of excitement as they were working on their skills and then watching them progress and get better at their skills. I fell in love with that process. And so when I retired, I knew I didn't want to work for anyone or have a 9-to-5, so to speak. So, I was just kicking around ideas, what's the best thing for me? Basketball's been my whole life. So let's figure out a way to dive into the basketball world. And I really wanted to make an impact on the basketball community as a whole in terms of teaching the game and training with athletes of all ages. And so that's kind of where it started in 99 and just kind of transferred over when I retired in 2003.
It's great to hear you talk about working with kids and I'm a teacher. I don't work in the classroom anymore, but there was, there was something pretty magical about introducing students to something that was your passion and your love and helping them understand it better and then seeing them to grow to love it even more. And there's a level of reward that comes that you can't really explain. Well, it's just something that you have to sit inside of and feel it when it's happening, but it's a beautiful thing. So
absolutely.
I totally get that. I was reading somewhere that your first client was Mike Turner. Is that correct?
Yes.
So, and you charged him $25 to be trained. Is that all accurate?
That is correct. I'm very accurate.
So Mike got the discounted rate of $25, and then 6 months later, your program just blew up. So how did you grow it? How did it become as big as it did so early on?
Yeah. I think I'm very uniquely placed in the industry because, again, when I started in the training world, the industry that is now, it didn't exist. All of the different mediums that you see now for trainers worldwide, that was non-existent. I had some mentors that trained me, but again, they were more just passionate guys who loved the game of basketball, and it wasn't really a bona fide business for them. So when I first started training Mike, he was in a very affluent area called Marin, which is like a very, very high-end area in Northern California. A lot of great schools, a lot of educational pieces in the community there. They're just very involved with just helping the youth through sports. So Mike was probably the best athlete in that area at the time. And he was one of the best high school players in California. And, you know, he really wanted to train and advance his skills. So I spent a tremendous amount of time with Mike and helping him improve. And I think a lot of people followed him in that area and kids wanted to know what he was doing. So my business grew from day one to year 13. It was 100% word of mouth. Uh-huh. I never had a website. I never did advertising. I never did marketing. I never did any of those things. And my business was 100% grown by word of mouth from client to client. And Mike was, his family was just a big advocate of what I was doing with him in terms of helping him become a better student athlete. And then the whole community of Marin, they just kind of jumped on board. And every week, more kids would reach out, more parents would reach out, more kids would show up to the workouts. And then just over a period of time, it grew from Mike Turner to about 75 kids. Wow. And it just continued to grow like that over a 13-year time frame.
Are you still in touch with Mike Turner?
Absolutely. So Mike is now currently running his own training business.
Wow.
Back in that same area. So it's for me, I think that's the most awesome thing, to see him go full circle and become a trainer and also start diving back into the community and doing what we started together. So it's amazing just to see him in that business like that.
That's great. So 2003 to 2011, you're focused on the training. Everything is mainly word of mouth. You're building a clientele. You're building reputation. You're becoming this trusted trainer. So nothing, no website, but now we live in a social media age and you do have a social media presence. So I actually have a question to ask you about your handle. And I'm wondering if mm-hmm. there's any hidden meaning in your Instagram handle.
Yeah, 94 Feet of Game is the name of the company that I started back in 99 when I started doing the training business. You know, my wife and I, we sat down and came up with the name 94 Feet of Game. And so what that personifies is, you know, 94 feet is the length of a basketball court mm-hmm. from baseline to baseline.
Yep.
And when I started the training business, my whole mindset was, I want to be able to help players become as complete as possible. And so, you know, you look at basketball players as point guards and shooting guards and small forwards and power forwards and centers. And I think a lot of people coach by position. And I've always tried to coach positionless basketball to make players complete. So the whole thing behind the 94 feet of game thing was, when you step on the floor, you should be as complete a player as possible. And I think the whole thing behind that was to help people understand, I don't think there's anything you shouldn't be able to do on the court as a basketball player. So hence 94 feet of game was just all encompassing to every player. And when I started my Instagram some years ago, there were some people that were kind of trying to toy around with my business name. They wanted to use it. So I just say, hey, this is the real 94 feet of game.
Yeah.
That's how that came to life.
I love that. I love that philosophy. And look, at when you think about the people that you've worked with, the players that you worked with, they definitely have encompassed that philosophy as well. Probably one of your most talented, and not to rank because there's too many, but one of the most famous that you've worked with closely was Kobe Bryant. Mm-hmm. What was it like for you to interact with that Mamba mentality?
Man, it was that was an amazing experience for me as a coach and a trainer. And then just somebody just having a pure basketball mind. I loved it. Me and Kobe were very alike in our mindset in terms of the game of basketball and our approach. He was a very detailed maniac. You know, I use that phrase because he lived in the details of the game, and he never wanted to skip any part of it, the process. And so I've always approached training in that same method. And so for me, man, it was just refreshing to be able to get with one of the best players to ever play and know that my mindset and my philosophy was on point. And just to be able to grow a relationship with him through the game of basketball was just a phenomenal thing to get to know him on and off the court. And just I learned so much from him as a coach. You know, I think a lot of times people think that coaches are the only ones that teach. But if we pay attention, players teach us every day as well. So it was just a great, great experience all the way around of having the opportunity to get to know him.
our parent company, Title League, obviously this is the Title League podcast, but Title League Incorporated has worked really closely with Danny Green in the past. And so I was listening to the mm-hmm. episode shortly after Kobe passed that had you and Quinn Cook on it. And you were telling the story of the 5:45 practice that Kobe had for you. Do you mind sharing that again for us?
Yeah, no, I think, when I got hired by the Lakers, I was charged with my head coach, Mike Brown at the time, to find out a way to build a relationship with Kobe. That was my directive. Mind you, that was my first year of ever coaching in the NBA. So I didn't know Kobe, didn't have a relationship with him. And I had to, figure out organically how to build a relationship with him. But I think I just set out about doing my job every day. And Kobe was the type of guy that, he would watch how people work. He would pay attention to how you carry yourself, players and coaches alike. And, my first few days on the job, he would just come out and sit and watch me work guys out for a couple of minutes. And then he would go back in the training room. And after about a couple of weeks of off and on, him watching, he shot me a text one afternoon about 2:00 in the afternoon and said, "Hey, I want you to meet me at the gym at 5:45. And so, I was ready to go. I was excited. I was just like, yeah, let's go. It's go time. So I get up and I go to the gym at about 5:00 in the evening. And, I sit there thinking, hey, okay, Kobe's the type of guy, he's going to be early, so I need to be before him. And 5:45 rolls around, he's not there. 6 p.m. rolls around, he's not there. I wait until 6:30 and he doesn't show up. And so I go home, and if anybody has ever trained with me and coached with me, they know that if me and a player, we organize a time and I'm there and you don't show up, I'm not the type of person that's going to call and text you and say, where are you? We made an agreement. You're supposed to be there. So I didn't call him. I didn't text him. I went home. Mm-hmm. And the next morning I come into practice. We practice at 10. I arrive at around 8 a.m. and I go down to the court and Kobe comes out of nowhere, just, kind of guns blazing. He's like, "Hey man, you just not going to show up for work?" And he's throwing F bombs at me, "What the F and what's going on?" I'm like, "Kobe, I was here. I was here last night at 5:45. And he gave me this look like, "You freaking idiot, you moron. I meant 5:45 this morning." And I just kind of looked at him and I was like, "Bruh," and I didn't really have much to say. And I started laughing. He wasn't laughing. And he was just like, "Man, be here tomorrow at 5:45 in the morning. Don't mess around. And that was kind of how our on-court relationship started. It was, I was kind of just shaking my head like, "Yeah, you idiot. That fool works out early in the morning. You should know that." So I just... That's how the relationship kind of started to develop on the court.
And then you guys went on to have a really close relationship. And here we are 5 months later and the loss is still felt, and apart from the grief that fans are feeling and then definitely friends and family are feeling, how do you think long-term his passing is going to impact the league?
The short term shows you already, his impact on the league, and not just the league, not just basketball, but his impact on the world was shown right away. I think the world came to a stop when everybody in that helicopter was pronounced, in that tragic accident. I don't think there was anybody in the world that didn't stop and reflect and have a moment of sadness and grief. And so it was immediate. And I think in the long term, I just think that Kobe's legacy is going to continue to grow every day and every year. He inspires so many people on and off the basketball court from just a mentality of how he approached his daily life. And again, I think that carries over into life and not just basketball. The mama mentality can apply to any walk of life, any industry of work. And I just think that, a lot of people were inspired by his mental toughness and just his drive to be great at what he was doing. And so I just think that's going to grow every year. And just, again, not just basketball. I think that's just going to grow in people's mentality on a daily basis.
Yeah, I love that. I think that's the biggest legacy or the biggest honor that you can give to somebody is carrying on the Mamba mentality, taking it on, making it grow to be even bigger than it could have been, and applying that to all aspects of your life. I love that. I think that's the best way to honor somebody as wonderful as he was.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Let's talk about how you transitioned into coaching. So what was the first coaching opportunity that you had, and how did that come about?
So through my training business, I obviously, over a 13-year time frame, I had an opportunity to work with a lot of NBA players, a lot of college players, a lot of elite-level high school players, European players. I pretty much touched every age range and category of basketball in my business. And, you know, I had the opportunity to take my first coaching job in the G League, and I was an assistant coach, in which I volunteered my time for Eric Musselman, who was the head coach of the Reno Bighorns, and back then it was called the D League. And so I was there for a season, and I spent the whole season, again, volunteering my time off and on between my business and going to help Eric coach his team. And I think that was a great educational thing for me to just understand, going from my private business in the private sector, going into going into a team capacity and figuring out how my skill set fits into coaching on a team level. And, you know, that was 2010. It was 2010. And then the following year, I got hired by the Lakers in 2011. And that was my first job in the NBA as a player development coach. And then the transition just kind of morphed. Here I am nine years later. You know, I'm back with the Lakers, and I've just kind of grown organically in the business as a development coach and just as an assistant coach.
And you're back again with one of the other greats, LeBron. So I'm going to have to talk to you about the 2016 NBA Finals and see if we can get some insight into that. So Cavs are facing your hometown team, Golden State, and there was a crushing game one loss, and definitely probably you heard it from friends and family after the game two loss. Take us back there. Take us back to the speech, to what you said to that team to have them rally and come back.
You know, Trish, I'm just a competitive guy. Like I said, I grew up the youngest of seven, youngest of six siblings. So scrapping and clawing and trying to figure out a way to have your voice heard and be seen. That was just how I grew up. I was a competitor by nature. And so, you know, being from Oakland and being from the Bay, it was one thing to just be there and be a part of the finals. You know, that was just a phenomenal opportunity growing up from there, and now to come back and be a coach and coaching in the NBA finals in your hometown was, you know, that was just a huge accomplishment for me. But I think after it kicked in, after the first year, I wanted to win. I wanted to become an NBA champion. And so the Warriors were just flat out kicking our ass. Excuse my language. They were killing us in game one and two. And I just, you know, felt like the guys weren't competing. They were not playing up to the level that we had demonstrated all through the playoffs. And we were just getting embarrassed. You know, they were mocking us. They were taunting us. They were talking shit. They were just, in every way possible, they were letting us know that, like, yo, you guys are not on our level. It's a joke that you guys are out here with us. And I just kind of took it that way. And, you know, T. Lou, our head coach, was gracious enough to give me the opportunity to vent and voice myself to the team. And Trish, honestly, I blacked out. All I remember is yelling, screaming. I got into a couple players' faces. You know, the owner, everybody from the organization was there, the owners were there, you know, our management was there. So I didn't really, there was no filter. I really was just trying to get to the better half of our players and make them understand, like, yo, man, we're in the NBA finals and we're out here playing like we have no competitive spirit. We're playing like a bunch of, you know what, and a lack of using words. And I really just wanted them to wake up and to compete. And Cleveland is a very hard-nosed city, very blue-collar, you know, people scrap and work for what they do there. And I felt like we were not representing that city mm-hmm. and what they stood for. And it was just a lot of F-bombs, a lot of other curse words that I won't share on this podcast. And really just, I was just so angry that we had got to this point in the season and we decided not to play hard and compete. And to their credit, and they all responded. I think they kind of woke up and just, you know, just say, man, look, at the end of the day, if we're going to lose, let's go down fighting. Let's fight for what we believe in as an organization. And, you know, obviously the rest is history.
Well, I'm not going to lie. I was hoping that there was going to be some Remember the Titans type like monologue that you're going to be able to recite for me again. But that's okay. That's all right. Blacking out is good. It worked. Whatever it was, it worked. But when did you realize, when did it click that something magical was going to stem from that?
We got back to Cleveland in game three. We showed up. We were a totally different team. I mean, we crushed the Warriors. We crushed, absolutely crushed them. So I knew at that point, I said, okay, now they know. They know. Like, we have something to give in this series. And although we came out and we lost game four, I think everybody still walked away from that feeling like, yeah, man, we messed up. We put ourselves in a hole. But I think everybody in that locker room felt like, man, we could beat these dudes. Mm-hmm. We can absolutely beat these dudes. And we were probably the only ones in the world at that point and being down 3-1. But game three was a great, tremendous sign. And then after we lost game four and we had to go back to Golden State being down 3-1, you know, LeBron and Coach T. Lou plainly stated to everyone in that locker room after the game, hey, listen, if you guys do not feel like or believe that we can go there and win this next game, do not get on the plane. Well, whoever doesn't believe it, stay here in Cleveland. We don't need you. That was the message.
Wow.
And everybody was calm. There was no, woe is me, or we're down 3-1. I'm telling you, it was the most absolute calm and quiet locker room that I've been a part of. The resolve was just like, yo, we got one game to win. Let's go take care of our business. And that was the attitude that everybody walked out of that locker room with after being down 3-1. And it just carried over to every game after that.
Yeah, that's definitely the attitude that you took back to California, for sure.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So let's talk about the next championship team, because, you know, that's near and dear to our heart. Before, you said mm-hmm. you said earlier that you've been to Nova Scotia, but prior to coming to Toronto to be on the Raptors team, how familiar were you with Canada and with our basketball program here?
Very. My time in the Lakers originally, when Steve Nash came to the Lakers, me and Steve Nash, we go way back to our college days. When Steve came to the Lakers, he actually asked me to come to Toronto and be a part of the Canadian national team. And so back in 2012-13, I started, you know, becoming an assistant coach with the national team with Jay wow. Triano. And I spent every summer in Toronto for about 2 or 3 weeks going through training camp with the national team and training the players and being a part of that. So I was very familiar with Toronto, the city, the culture, the people, the food, just the vibe of Toronto is an amazing vibe. And so, you know, having the opportunity to get up there and coach was something that I was really excited about.
And you came up with Kawhi, but what are the details around that opportunity? How did you come to Toronto?
Well, I came before Kawhi.
Okay.
So a lot of people think that me and Kawhi came together, but no, I actually, when my contract was up in Cleveland, you know, I was kind of looking for the next opportunity. There's all these underlying factors. Me and Nick Nurse have a long history. I played for Nick Nurse in Europe, one of those countries I played for in England. He was my head coach. And so I played for Nick Nurse some 20 years before came to Toronto. We always kept in touch. You know, obviously when I was in Cleveland, we had some pretty deep-rooted playoff series against the Raptors. So me and Nick were always in touch and communicating. And when he got the job, you know, we kind of just had a casual conversation about what's next for me. And, you know, we kind of met and just went through the whole process of figuring out if I'd be a good fit for his staff. And ultimately, I figured, and I looked at Toronto's team after playing against them for so many years, and I knew that LeBron was leaving the East and going out West. And I just kind of felt like, man, there's a great opportunity for this team, the players that they have. They're very good. So maybe this is the opportunity that we can, you know, those guys can get over the hump. And I really felt that way with DeMar and Kyle and all the other talent that they had. You know, I was really looking forward to the opportunity of working with DeMar and spending time with Kyle. And so I signed my contract with the Raptors with that roster. And then 2 days later, after I signed my contract, I woke up early in the morning one morning and saw on ESPN that the Raptors had made a blockbuster trade for Kawhi Leonard for DeMar DeRozan. Mm. And I really fell out of my chair. The morning I saw that news, and it was just like, man, this can't be real. You know, because again, I had already always held DeMar in a very high respect and just the type of player he was. And I was looking forward to the opportunity of working with him and trying to help him continue to grow. And then the trade came, and it was just like, okay, well, I guess that's going to have to shift the mindset. But, you know, you trade one great player for another great player, and you just say, well, let's get to work. And that's how that all kind of developed.
So you were there first. That's good. We'll set the record straight. Let's talk about that, though, that trade. And, you know, there's lots of hindsight that's attached to it. And obviously it worked out well for Toronto because they got the chip. So, but what at the time did you think was going – did you think that that was the right move, or did you have any reservations?
No, I can't say that I had any reservations because I never knew Kawhi. I didn't know him personally, but I knew what kind of competitor he was. And he was a fierce competitor, just like DeMar. So I don't think, in my mindset, I didn't skip a beat. I always felt and came to Toronto with the mindset of, like, this team has the ability to compete for a championship. And so when the trade happened, that didn't change for me. It didn't escalate one way or another. I just say, man, we have a chance to compete for a championship. And, you know, my mind just quickly turned to, okay, what's my job now? Now my job is to build a relationship with Kawhi and Kyle and Pascal and all the other guys on the team. And so I really dug into that and was just like, yo, let's go. We're all in this thing together. And that's just, you know, that's just the type of mindset that I carry. And so I just knew what I knew of Kawhi as a player and a competitor. I still felt very strongly about being able to compete for a championship.
You know, you have a 20-year relationship with Nick Nurse. What have you guys learned from each other over the course of that relationship?
Well, I think, you know, it's always different when you play for someone than you work with them. Mm. You know, Nick was, I think he's the same fiery coach that he was back then. I think the only difference is, you know, more experience and just learning and growing as a coach, learning different philosophies. And I think he took all of those things that he did back then and he applied them with the team in Toronto as a head coach. And, you know, he's the same dude. He's the same fiery coach. Like, you know, Nick was a competitor. Like when we played in England, he hated losing. You know, and I believe the season that I was there, we had our record was crazy. We went like 47-5 or something like that. We didn't lose very many games. And he was hell bent on not losing. You know, and as an NBA coach, it's hard to, you know, hard to have a perfect season, but you know, we took every game serious and we tried to win every game last year in Toronto. And that was his approach. He didn't approach it any different. And so it was just good to see that, you know, 20 years later, Nick is the same guy, just a little bit sharper, a little bit more wiser, you know, more experienced. But he still carried the same philosophies that he had in England.
Do you think that he's taken anything away from you? What do you think in this season, without you there, what did he learn from you?
You know, man, I think as coaches, we learn from each other. No. I think that's the nature of the business. If we're not learning from each other, we're not growing. And I think Nick learned from me, you know, one, he saw how serious I took my job as a coach and my dedication to working with the players day in and day out, and then my preparation. You know, I think I was able to help that organization, that team, and just how I prepared every day. you know, from the regular season to the playoffs and to the finals. You know, I had vast experience just from being a part of the finals the four previous years. So, you know, I was able to bring some experience in that way in terms of, hey, these are the things that I've done and been a part of to be successful, to make it to that NBA Finals series. And I think I was able to help a lot in those regards and just bringing that experience of what it takes to try to get over the hump. And Nick was, again, as a coach, as a head coach, he was gracious enough to allow all of us to have input and coach and give our mindsets. And he took from us all. No, I don't think he wasn't closed minded at all. And I just think his open mindedness allowed him to continue to grow and learn different things. And so we were sharing in that space of what does it take to be a champion. And I think that's just something that we kind of bounced off of each other every day.
I think that's great. And once again, you were back in San Francisco for a final. So what were those two championships or the two finals? How are they different? Like, what was the feeling with the Toronto Golden State finals?
You know, I think similar, very similar, right? There's a lot of history. Cleveland had not won a championship in 50 some odd years. You know, so the weight of that was on LeBron's shoulders. He carried that. You know, look, he doesn't feel pressure, but you could tell that he carried that weight of saying, man, this is the only reason why I'm here is to try to bring a championship to this city. And to be a part of that historically was amazing. Like, to be a part of helping the city and the state of Ohio, you know, gain some respect in that way. You know, because Cleveland's kind of looked at as like, oh, that's the town of, you know, bad luck. You know, there's a curse in that town. Mm-hmm. And so it was amazing to be a part of that, to uplift that and bring a championship to that city. And then to just be a part of the only team in NBA history to ever come back from a 3-1 deficit. Just there's all these things of just making history that were phenomenal. And then, you know, taking that same thought process to Toronto, to be a part of the first NBA team outside of the United States to win a championship, and not only for Toronto, but for that whole country. I felt like Canada stood up and said, look, we're gonna support you guys. We're going to push you guys. We're behind you 100%. And I felt like I'm right now doing this interview, I'm getting goosebumps because I just remember the Jurassic Park and then the offsite Jurassic Parks that were popping up all over Canada on game days. It was that was an amazing experience to be a part of, and to see that country that's typically, you know, traditionally a hockey country, and to see that country like really dive into basketball and be part of the culture for that, you know, 2-week period. I just really, man, that was an awesome experience. Equally, as well, I just, you know, to be able to be part of those two franchises and help make history for their cultures, I think that's something that's for any other championship I win, I don't think can measure up to just being a part of such historical moments.
I couldn't agree with you more. And for the record, Tidal League was actually the organizers for Halifax's Jurassic Park. We were the ones we were affiliated.
Yeah, well,
so I was there. I was there with you. We were sweeping up the streets of Halifax after our thousands of people gathered to watch the games, and we were celebrating. And you definitely had a country there. It was the whole country from coast to coast who was behind
this
team. So it's that those feelings are still real. So we still have so much love and so much respect. Which championship did you enjoy more?
You know what? Both. You know, people ask me that. People know, like literally, people ask me that all the time because they're both special. They're both special. I think Toronto was one that I was able to enjoy more. I think when I won the first championship, was part of that in Cleveland, it happened so fast, right? It was just here, boom, championship, you won it. And it didn't, I don't think it really registered until later. And just, I don't really feel like I had the opportunity to enjoy what was happening. When I got to Toronto, you know, and again, you know, there's no guarantees, but as I was going through that process, I enjoyed it. Like, I was engaged. I was involved with it every day. I didn't, you know, the first time I was kind of, I won't say nervous, but, you know, and just in a little bit of disbelief, like, oh, man, I'm here in the NBA Finals. There's a chance to win a championship in Game 7. Yeah, I didn't really get to enjoy the process. And in Toronto, I felt like I enjoyed it. I lived it. I was present in everything that we were doing every day. And the parade was unbelievable. I was there. I was present. I understood what was happening, and to where I was more prepared, I guess you could say, to understand what it feels like to win a championship. And so Toronto, I feel like I definitely have a different perspective, and because I was engaged and involved with everything that went on that year.
Well, we're still feeling it. We're still celebrating. Thanks to the hiatus, we're still the champions. So we'll see how long it lasts.
Hey, absolutely, man. Hey, listen. Even though I'm not in Toronto and I'm coaching for the Lakers, until somebody knocks us off, that team is still champion.
That's right. You're still a champion with them.
No question. So, hey, like, people think I take offense to that. I'm like, nah, bring it on. We're still champions until somebody dethrones that team.
Until we have a Raptors Lakers final, and then we'll see what's gonna happen.
Hey, and then for me, it's a win-win.
Yes, that's right. For you.
Yep.
So speaking of the hiatus and COVID-19, you know, it's clear that you are a hands-on coach. You are somebody who works closely and intimately with their players. How has this inability to be hands-on impacted you?
You know, honestly, Trish, it's impacted me in a very positive way because, yes, I am hands-on, like to be on the court. But, you know, this COVID thing is a real life. You know, look, a lot of people have lost their lives from it. People have lost loved ones. You know, this is, it's giving you a reality check of one, hey, we're in the sporting world. You know, we coach and play basketball and, you know, we do what we love and get paid for it. So let's put that in place and put in perspective and what it is. The COVID has really allowed me to dive back into my passion of the game. And, you know, I've spent majority of my time during this period working on my app, which is, you know, it's called the 94 Future Game app, which is all basketball training. It's all drill work. It's the Phil Handy philosophy of teaching basketball over the years. It's all in one place on my app. And so what I've been doing is really trying to ignite the basketball community to not have an excuse not to work. And through the app, you know, I've sent our players at-home workouts, virtual workouts, Zoom workouts. You know, they have a ton of stuff from our app to where they can keep themselves busy. But I've also tried to dive into and put this app out into the universe for kids and parents and coaches and trainers to say, hey, look, you know, we don't have a gym. We may not have a basketball court, but there is still something that we can do at home or in our backyard. You know, don't just give in to this whole virus thing and just say, hey, man, I can't do anything. So it's had a really huge and positive impact on me because when I did dive into the app, I've seen the response from the kids. And this kind of take me back to where I started working with youth. And the kids have responded, Trish, bigger than I could have ever expected.
Awesome.
I get probably 60 to 70 videos every day from kids sending me the workout drills that they're doing in their backyard. They're doing it in their living room. They're doing it in their garage. And it's inspired me beyond anything that I could have ever expected. And just the community and the movement behind that has really grown. And so I've just really tackled that and say, hey, well, I'm going to jump in this with both feet and do whatever I can to help the basketball community to thrive during this crazy time.
That's really remarkable. So that chemistry can be developed virtually. It doesn't need to be in person.
It can. Yeah. I believe, you know, if you... Again, it's all about how you teach, how you communicate, and how people receive it. So, you know, I think the app has been far more impactful than I ever thought it would be, honestly. I knew that people would take a liking to it because there's a ton of people that want to understand the way I train. But the impact that it's had is really shown me that, yes, this is a virtual world. Things can be done off-site. And people have accepted that challenge and just kind of ran with it.
So you've trained some of the greatest. We've talked about Kobe, we've talked about LeBron, all of the Raptors, because they're all my favorite and they're all great. But what, you know, what actually separates these players? Is there a thin line? Can you become an elite player with the right training or with the right mindset?
Yeah, I think there is a thin line, Trish. One, what people don't realize, most of you think about all of the elite players ever to play the game, they were naturally blessed with some kind of physical attribute that's just out of this world, right? God has blessed these guys with some natural ability that they were born with, and they took that and ran with it in how hard they work. They are the hardest working individuals in the sport, hands down, and people need to understand how hard they work on and off the court, you know, not only in their craft, but in their bodies. The thin line is they've combined the natural ability they've been given, and they're not afraid to outwork everyone. That's what they live on. They're going to outwork you to where now, you know, that God-given talent that they have is just, it's magnified on a whole nother level. And they're just, they're ultra competitive. You know, they are competitors of the highest level in the sense that they want to be the best. They push themselves every day and they push the envelope to be the best. And so I, you know, look, you can train to be an elite level athlete for sure. Mm-hmm. But I think there takes, you know, there has to be some certain things that you get some luck with along the way. Again, i.e. being blessed with some talent, having the aptitude and understanding of what it takes from a work ethic standpoint. And those guys understand it. They understand it and they gravitate towards it. They don't run from it.
Do you think that transfers into coaching as well as playing? So you have, it's probably the most high profile coaching bench in professional sports, Frank Vogel, Jason Kidd, Lionel Hollins. Does that elite level of coaching raise your level of coaching being a part of them?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think from an individual standpoint, I think that I fit right in with those guys. You know, my ability and the opportunities I've had over the last few years to, one, to coach in five straight finals, and two, some of the guys I've had a chance to coach and help them be successful, it absolutely fits into the mold of great coaches, because I think great players help great coaches and vice versa. It's not a one-way street. One thing I learned about being next to Kobe, Bron, Kyrie, Steve Nash, you know, Kawhi, all these guys, they demand greatness from you as a coach. And so your level has to raise too. If you're going to help them be great, your level has to be up there. If they're going to be great, their level has to be up there. So those dudes have all pushed me as a coach to be great. And we have to be on point with our responsibilities. There's no time for sleep or rest. You know, you as a coach, you have to have that same drive, that same motivation, and that same work ethic to be at the elite level. And you know, I feel like it's been a complete blessing and honor for me to grow in this business and to be part of the coaching staff that we have here in LA.
That's great. And this is an observation, no judgment at all. You are amongst greatness, and from players to coaches. How do you balance ego?
I think where I come from, I was born and raised into a family of humility. And my father was just old school in terms of just work. You have to have a work ethic. So for me, you know, I put blinders on to all that other stuff. I love the game of basketball. I love it. And it's blessed me through and through in my life. It's blessed my family in ways that I can't even describe. So I try not to tarnish that love for the game. I always try to keep it pure. And I think, you know, the game of basketball is a tremendous sport. And once you, as an individual, whether you're a coach, player, trainer, whatever, once you start to have this attitude that you're bigger than the game, you're going to fall flat on your face. Mm-hmm. And so I've always tried to remain and have the sense of being humble in all things, because I think as fast as this stuff is given to you, it could be quickly taken away. Mm-hmm. And so I try not to take none of it for granted. You know, I've been coaching in the league for 9 years, which is not a long time. There's been a lot of coaches that have been coaching in the NBA for 20 plus years who've never been to the NBA finals. They've never been to a conference finals, and they've been at this for a longer time than me. And so I look at all of those things and say, man, yes, you are tremendously blessed. You know, you've had some good fortune. Yes, you put in some hard work, but don't get it twisted. You know, this could go totally different. So I'm keeping humility at the forefront of everything I do. I'm grateful. I'm appreciative every day. And I think if we carry that attitude, then it allows us, one, to continue to grow and learn. And, you know, it just allows us to be ready to absorb different things and not feel like this is all about us, because I just love the game, and I'll do whatever I can to help the game move forward.
Amen. Phil, one last question before we let you go today. What do you want your legacy in the game of basketball to be when it's all said and done?
Man, that's a great question. I want my legacy to be that I love the game so much that I don't care what corner of the earth it's on, where it is, I'll teach it. I'll do it. I'll be a part of it. I want people just to remember how hard I worked in helping players, helping the game on a universal scale. That's really what I'm all about. I want the game of basketball to be in a healthy place through and through. And so I live my life for that right now. I think that's what I live for. That's what I feel like. That's what I'm put on this earth to do, is to inspire people through the game of basketball to try to do something great. You know, that's feel like that's been my calling, and I'm moving towards that every day. So hopefully people can see that passion for me, and it resonates with people that don't even have anything to do with basketball, because I think it's all about just having a mindset for life.
Well, Phil, the game is blessed to have you, and I feel very thankful to have been joined with you today. I hope that you stay healthy and well, and look forward to seeing what happens once our season resumes.
Trish, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. You guys, you too. Stay safe, stay healthy, and I hope you're enjoying your time with your loved ones.
Thank you. You too.